identified in the case law some concern to balance a range of considerations, the certainty for landowners. And part of that might be answered by the extent to which, in reality, even for stage one, KiwiRail has to have all the land parcel puzzles in place. In other words, it may be that you are aiming at 15 years not because you're trying to defer land purchases so much as being realistic about the time that it takes to implement this out, given the scale of it, and that one operating incentive to quick purchase or ongoing purchase would be the fact that you can't build a stormwater system that's fit for purpose unless you have acquired those parts as well as the, you know what I'm saying? In the sense it's,
yep,
they're all parts of the whole, even if they're not built correctly. So what I'd like to understand from KiwiRail and the witnesses is how the practical build out of an activity like this, even for stage one, will require you to have those other envelopes in place.
Yes.
And to some extent that will be partially answered by the extent to which we have components or precincts in the designation, because if the stormwater precincts are actually going to be the stormwater precincts, you can't put a stormwater pond elsewhere. So it in a sense becomes an integrated puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to get into the lapse question and find myself making mistaken assumptions. If KiwiRail's position is we need 15 years because that's what it's going to take to implement, but we're not going to shy away from the land acquisition because of these reasons, and those incentives or realities are built in, that might affect how we weigh that issue.
Okay.
So I need to understand that.
Okay.
I hope that it's a little bit long-winded, but
no,
I hope that
I
makes sense.
Thank you. Yes.
We'll come to noise, but those sorts of things. But we're also very interested, I think, as a panel, in how some of those how those mitigation measures will be implemented relative to stage one, so that there is the mitigation is implemented at an early stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just check my notes. Where have we got to with Palmerston North City Council? And Mr. Van Benten refers to an infrastructure agreement.
Mm.
I'm not sure that we should be using this process to try and negotiate an agreement with the council, but I'm kind of interested, is that something that we're going to be asked to resolve through this process, or is it... No,
sir, I think you're... Council notes that certainly that's something that KiwiRail and the council have been discussing, but in my submission that's outside this process,
right.
Not for the panel with respect to assess. This needs to stand on its own, doesn't it?
Yeah, but is it correct that legally the council has a trump card in the sense that it has the first designation on Railway Road, and it can refuse consent until its integration requirements are met.
Mm.
So our concern that integration will not be achieved attracts some degree of unreality, given the fact that the statute provides the council with the gatekeeper role of some of these core assets.
Mm.
Is that a fair statement of the law?
I think that's fair in the sense that there's, of course, a risk to any developer or requiring authority that comes second in time in relation to a designation that they're seeking to apply over another's, and that prevent and hinder ability for the underlying designation, your words, to trump. That's certainly I think is a risk, of course, for KiwiRail, but in my submission and given the huge amount of conversation, discussion and planning with the city and a range of people there with KiwiRail, I think the best I can say is KiwiRail's comfortable with that level of risk.
Yeah, it's just that it seemed to me from Mr. Van Bentham's evidence that he was looking for something from us, from the process, and it seemed to me that the council had quite a lot of cards in its hand anyway.
Exactly. I think without, you know, it's one thing we'll get into, I think, over the course of the next week or so, some of the proposed conditions that came through from council on Friday. I think going a little bit towards some of those broader, potentially matters that are perhaps ones for project agreement or similar, you know, for example, around the water bore and its extension and KiwiRail needing to acquire and give land to the council as a condition to be imposed on this NOR. So I think there's some further discussion and conversation to have around some of those matters. Probably the best we can take it in relation to the statutory process we're in here.
Right. Is there any risk that by confirming the designation in terms of its extent, you then get a third applicant for a designation over part of it for the ring road? So you actually have three designations. And the ring road then requires consent from you because you're the earliest. And has anyone modelled or considered that potential? Or is that fanciful because the ring road wouldn't conceptually impact in that way?
I think in relation to some of those sort of signposted, but as yet still uncertain in a statutory sense, matters like Bunnythorpe Bypass or the ring road, there's still clearly additional work that those requiring authorities or road controlling authorities need to do. And in the same way, I suppose you note that the council has it, the trump card or, reality of that existing railway road designation. Equally, if this designation is NOR is confirmed, then that's a factor for Waka Kotahi or the council to have regard to when it's thinking about the ring road. KiwiRail's position is that the land it's seeking to designate and the extent of that land is required for hub purposes, but also in relation to those wider roading integration matters, and I think Mr. Georgeson will be able to speak to this tomorrow, there is a clear understanding from KiwiRail about how it needs to work to integrate with those other road controlling authorities.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear from Mr. Georgeson about that integration, because I don't want create levels of designation that are conflicting without them, at least the opportunity for speaking to each other, because integration would be highly desirable. I'm not sure whether that has any relationship to the topic of making that Kairanga Bunnythorpe Road intersection safe at an early time. It might be an unrelated topic, but that is something that I'm also particularly interested in because I am familiar with the locality. And I know that that is a very suboptimal intersection, and it's going to require some attention at an early stage. And in some ways, it will have to involve KiwiRail anyway, because it's the railway line and the intersection together. I think I'll ask, I might have some further questions. I'll just review your submissions, but I'll ask other panel members to ask some questions first. Jenny, would you like to start?
Good afternoon, Ms. Arthur Young, Ms. Ratley, Thank you for your submissions. Just a few points of clarity, mainly around RMA interpretation issues. Starting from the beginning in 2.3, where you're talking about the benefits of the proposal, the relationship of climate change and the RMA has always been quite a vexed issue, and maybe round version whatever of the RMA that we get next might address that further. But at this point in time, to what extent can we consider the benefits that the proposal might result in fewer emissions?
It's certainly in relation to what happens with Section 104 in, out, end of this year and so on, and then probably being changed in the next couple of years is a separate matter. But in my submission, the benefits around a reduction in emissions, I suppose, probably more in the sense of that broader sustainability story around getting freight off roads and onto rail, and thereby reducing emissions, I think very comfortably sits within, in particular, the sustainable management purpose of Section 5. And on just about every regard, you know, sustaining the potential of natural physical resources, safeguarding life-supporting capacity of air, water, soil, and systems. I think even at that more sort of general and philosophical level, without looking into 104 around greenhouse gas emissions or anything like that, our submission is that benefit of getting freight, getting traffic off roads and onto rail where there's reduced emissions is something absolutely that is able to be had regard to under Part 2.
So I'll ask it in a different way, because obviously in the Act there are particular sections which says that we can't have consideration of the effects on climate change, but we can of climate change. Mm-hmm. Confusing. Is there anything in the Act that says that we can't consider the benefits that would arise from the reduction of emissions?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you.
I mean, the soon-to-be-lifted 104E, you know, when you're considering applications and relating to discharge permits, for example, at present, must not have regard to the effects of such a discharge on climate change. That's going pretty soon, but that's not the situation here.
Turning to the issue of positive effects and benefits as well, something that several of the experts have raised is that there will be positive effects associated with the decommissioning of the existing freight yard. We're here to consider submissions on the proposed new freight hub. So my question to you is, what level of weight can we actually give to those positive effects, given that we have no scope of consideration or influence over whether or not that happens at all? And certainly that's something that submissions have raised, is what assurance is there that we won't, that they won't end up with a freight hub still remaining at Tremaine Avenue and a new freight hub as well?
That's a very good question, and certainly you don't have an application before you for a change in use or an application for what that Tremaine Ave land will be used for. The evidence that you do have, however, is that those freight and hubbing activities will be moving from, that's the key rail evidence, is that those, you won't have two hubs, that freight hubbing activity will be moving to the new location. So in that regard, in my submission, you can have regard to the fact that those hubbing activities will be moving to a more suitable location. But Commissioner, I agree that you can't and don't have an application before you to consider what might go in its place. But my submission is you do have evidence that says those activities, those busy hubbing activities, will be moving to the new site.
Talking about those busy existing activities on Tremaine Avenue, and in answering the chair's questions before about those existing freight forwarding activities on Tremaine Ave, which we saw when we did our site visit, did any of those require separate resource consents for their establishment?
I would have to check that in terms of how actually those activities were endorsed. I can check that for you and come back.
I assume that the site's designated.
The site is designated.
Yeah.
So I anticipate they sit under the, you know, the designation. I can confirm that for you.
That would be useful if you could. I suppose that would help us understand in terms of what the council has accepted before in the past in terms of being within the scope of the Kiwi Rail designation activity. Mm. You, and I realise Ms. Bell addresses this in her evidence, but when you were taking us through the matters relating to Section 6 of the Act, you brought our attention to Section 6D in terms of public access, noting that there's currently no public access to the streams or tributaries, but public access to waterways will be enhanced by recreational tracks around the stormwater pond. I'm on page 28 here. Just like your advice in terms of how provision of recreational tracks around stormwater ponds actually sits in terms of Section 6D.
I might jump in and answer that one if I may. So this is a matter that has arisen in terms of Ms. Rimmer's evidence, and also Ms. Bell talks about it in the AEE. In terms of those recreational tracks which are shown on the concept plan as coming, connecting into the Bunnythorpe community and coming around the stormwater ponds, and providing that those access to the Mangoni stream and surrounding environs.
I'm just wondering about the level of weight that we should be giving to that in terms of addressing a Section 6 matter.
Mm.
Section 6D is quite precise in terms of its reference to access to lakes or rivers.
Mm. And I think rivers in that context, in terms of streams in this context, being the Mangoni stream, and so those recreational tracks connecting to, take your point around the stormwater ponds, but I think it's broader as far as those connecting to the tributaries which then connect to the Mangoni stream, which is, I guess, to the north area of the site.
And just to add to that, Mem, in relation to the definition of river in the Act, it includes streams. So we're actually talking about the public access, particularly up around this aspect of the site, as opposed to down there, noting that public access will go around those ponds. But up here in particular, there'll be public access provided around the stream.
So what's noted here? Are you saying we should be rather looking at that access to the tributaries rather than access to stormwater ponds?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification.
I think just one, oh no, a couple more. I was very intrigued about how we should be sticking to our statutory lanes, and what you meant by that, Ms. Arthur Young. Obviously, as I looked through the the conditions as they've grown and developed, and particularly reading through the council's recommended conditions that came through on Saturday. I noted that the council, for instance, is now advocating for a operational air quality management plan, and a lot more in the ecological front as well.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult in these situations for large-scale projects like these to not, I suppose, consider all effects. So what I'd really like to understand more from you is what you meant to us in terms of sticking to our statutory lanes.
Certainly. Probably, I don't think anything particularly to be read into that phrase, other than I think it's precisely around that desire, as I can appreciate it, coming from the council in particular and their experts around those regional issues, for example, air quality and those other points you've talked about, that I suppose in no way meant to be pejorative about lanes, but actually those statutory lanes around matters which are land use and district or city council matters, and matters which are regional matters. And that's simply what I meant by that phraseology, where I think one of the key areas of tension, as I've flagged in my presentation, where we're thinking about the conditions to apply to this designation, which is a land use designation, it's not a regional, you can't, as the panel will well know, designations can't cover off or endorse regional matters, they're very separate things. So that's simply what I meant, where there are certainly a range of those matters which need to be considered and assessed, but where, in my submission, some of the conditions particularly proposed by council experts start to veer into regional consenting matters, matters that will appropriately and robustly be tested at the regional consenting level. That's what I meant in relation to lanes, simply around the sort of land use, district, city controls versus regional roles.
So just intervene here. So when the relevant witness comes to address us and there is a condition where you think the lane has been crossed, can you interpolate into that and explain that when we get to that witness, so that we understand precisely in relation to each condition where it matters what your point is?
Certainly, sir. We will do that, and the experts will do that. I think there's been some, as Commissioner Sweetman has noted, some of the new areas like air discharge, so that's something that those experts are thinking carefully about. But stormwater, for example, has been an issue that is covered. I think Mr. Leahy seeks to unpack that in his evidence, but he will do that again when he presents to you.
Yeah, and I need to understand that, because stormwater is both a territorial and regional function, as is dust. So there are some where the lines are blurred, excuse the pun, but others where it's not so much.
One of my favourites is always the NPSFM, having been involved with it for many, many years now. And I'm probably answering my own question to some degree here, but I was interested in your submissions around the NPSFM as it stands in 2020-2021, particularly in terms of the incorporation of those particular provisions in 3.22 and 3.24 in terms of wetlands and loss of river extent. And we're all trying to still get our heads around the new NPSFM. Is it your understanding with these particular clauses or whatever they're called, I still haven't quite figured out what you call these, that they are matters that the regional council has to basically implement through its regional plan? So they're not direct insertion policies as we saw under previous iterations of the NPSFM?
Yes, ma'am. You know, every regional council must include the following policy or words to the same effect in its regional plan. That's 3.24. Every regional council must include the following policy or words to the same effect in its regional plan. 3.24.
So, I understand that. So, where the Act provides that national policy statements can include direct insertion policies that basically don't have to go through a Schedule 1 process.
Yes.
Regional Section Council 55. Just has to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right that these are different to those direct insertion policies, that they have to go through a Schedule 1 process?
There are a handful which, so in Auckland, for example, Section 55 direct insertion policies. Let's check again if those are these ones. And then the rest are a Schedule 1 process. Now, these direct insertion ones, I think you're right in relation to, I can get Ms. Bell to clarify, but those provisions, or whatever we call them, those specific requirements of Part 3 ones that you've just referenced, I understand 3.22 and 3.24 are the Section 55 direct insertion ones, you're right. So in the one plan, my understanding, though, those haven't yet been directly inserted. We couldn't see that. And I don't think they have yet. And the rest of the provisions are for a Schedule 1 process. Mr. Jessen may have clarity. I don't know if they have been included
in the
one
plan. Mr. Jessen might want to clarify that. And my personal understanding is they're not direct insertion ones. But
we'll clarify that.
Would be useful. Thank you. Because it does... You were talking about the whole context of the NPSFM needing to go through a regional process to be incorporated into a regional plan.
Mm-hmm. To clarify, those submissions I made were in the context of the Te Mana Otawai provisions,
right,
which require the Schedule 1 plan-making process. But certainly, and I think it is these ones, they're the direct insertion points, but my submissions were in relation to Te Mana Otawai.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kia ora. Tēnā kōrua. Thanks very much for your legal submissions. They've been most helpful. Can you hear me all right? Okay. I don't have too many questions for you because, as has been pointed out in your submissions and in the evidence Kiwi Rail has provided, we are relying predominantly on the evidence to be presented by the iwi submitters to provide us with clarity on the cultural effects. So I don't have many questions for you in that regard, but just at a higher level, in terms of your Part 2 assessment that begins on page 27, I'm just wanting to get some a better understanding of the basis upon which you have come to the conclusion that, and at this reasonably early stage in the proceedings, that the project is consistent with sections 6E, 7A and 8. I'm particularly interested in understanding, I guess, where things are at in terms of progress in advancing the mana whenua engagement framework, which I understand has been relied on to some extent, if not to the greatest extent, in terms of the conclusion that you've made about the consistency of the project with these provisions. Whether or not, I guess in the first instance, to what extent agreement has been reached with Mana Whenua in respect to that engagement framework.
Thank you, Commissioner. So just in relation to a few of those matters, again, probably starting from the back first, in terms of an update on where things are at, Ms. Poulsen will be able to address you on that.
Yes.
And we're grateful for that opportunity. Also, too, as you note, I mean, the evidence that we are going to hear, particularly next week from the lease submitters, will form that evidence that will be so important for you in your decision-making process. And that evidence will necessarily form part of your assessment. Mm-hmm. And also, in hearing that evidence and listening carefully to it, will enable KiwiRail to reflect and respond to that, including, again, in the iterative way these processes go, the conditions that we've posited. So I think next week is going to be very important to hear that evidence. In relation to how we can submit, as you say, in relation to part two, in my submission, for example, in relation to the Section 6 matters that you, when considering this NOR, shall recognize and provide for example, the relationship of Māori and their culture and traditions. In my submission, that with the very broad proposed condition that we have sought, noting again that I anticipate and hope that will continue to be refined mm-hmm. over the next couple of weeks when we hear from directly from submitters and hear their evidence. But even now, my submission is based on the condition we have, noting that we need to hear and work with in an ongoing way, iwi partners. In my submission, you will be able to recognize and provide for example, that 6E matter in the condition we've proposed.
Mm. Thank you for that clarification. I guess what concerns me a little is that, I mean, I understand we have the condition, but I don't understand that we have agreement from the Mana Whenua parties involved in these discussions. And without their agreement, I wonder to what extent the condition is really relevant and to what extent the condition can provide us with the assurance that's necessary to ensure that the project is in fact consistent with those Māori provisions in part two of the Act. Mm. Are you able to comment further on that at this point?
I think at this point, ma'am, probably I can't take that much further in the sense that our submission at this point is noting as well the range of discussion and kōrero that KiwiRail has had with a range of iwi over the last couple years certainly does inform where we've got to and does inform where that draft condition came from.
Mm.
And certainly I know, and you will probably know better than anybody in this room, that sometimes we come to these processes and an applicant or developer hasn't thought about any of these things at all or indeed had any conversations and proposed sort of a stock standard condition. In my submission, that's not the situation we're in now. No, there is not at this stage an absolute agreement necessarily on the condition proposed, CV or the like. There has also been a lot of discussion to get up to this point.
Mm.
So that's probably as far, I think, with respect, we can take it.
Okay.
But certainly, I anticipate you have some questions from Ms. Poulsen, and she can talk about that further.
Thank you. I appreciate I appreciate the difficulty in responding to that with any further clarity at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I will leave it there. Just one further clarification in relation to the stormwater and flooding effects. On page 32 at paragraph 6.13, the last sentence there, you mention that there are some minor technical areas of disagreement, and this is between the council's experts and report and Kiwi Rail. And I was just wondering, I know there is a reference there to the Section 42A report, but I was just wondering, could you please just clarify what those minor technical areas of disagreement were?
Thank you. I might ask Ms. Rapp.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this has been addressed in Mr. Leahy's evidence, and yes, that might actually be the best port of call. There are a couple of aspects in terms of the disagreement, in the sense that there are a few technical matters, which has really primarily been between Mr. Leahy and the stormwater and flooding aspects. But there is also a planning component to this in terms of a minor disagreement between Ms. Bell and the reporting planners as to how the stormwater management conditions are currently reflected. And that really comes back to the ongoing conversation we've been having as far as what is managed in terms of the regional consent process and what is should be provided for in terms of the district land use aspects of the proposal. But in terms of the experts, they're generally aligned as far as overall, in the sense that there's sufficient land within the designation and we can be comfortable that the stormwater effects, you know, in this context at a land use level can be managed within the designation site.
But what about if they can't be managed within the designation site, for instance? And I'm thinking back to, I think it was the Section 42A report that referred to the different zoning requirements as far as stormwater is concerned. And in the industrial area, I think it was 10% of stormwater discharge was to be retained and managed on site within detention ponds. And that's, I understand, to be feasible. But there seemed to be some disagreement over whether or not those rules that apply to the industrial part of the freight hub land would also apply eventually to the whole site. And I was just wondering whether, from a legal perspective, you were able to provide any clarification on that point.
So in terms of the Northeast Industrial Zone provisions, and Mr. Leahy can speak to this in more detail, as can Ms. Bell, but my understanding is that in carrying out their stormwater management assessment and in terms of the effects, they have considered those matters and consider that in terms of what's been provided in the designation extent that we can meet those requirements. Obviously, there's a detailed design process that needs to be undertaken and more detailed hydraulic modelling, but the position of Kiwi Rail at this point in time, based on Mr. Leahy's work, is that we can comfortably manage those effects within the site.
Right. Okay, thank you.
I'm just going to jump in again that I answered my own question by looking at the NPSFM. So 1.7 basically is those directive insertion for those particular provisions. But that ultimately does mean that it is just a simple thing for the regional council to do, isn't it? Is pick them up, put them in, no challenge.
Absolutely. And several other regional councils around the country have already done just that.
Okay. We'll come back to that, Mr. Jessen. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Arthur Young and Ms. Rapley. I have one hopefully fairly quick question. And this goes back to the lapse period that Commissioner Marsden has already touched on in terms of trying to manage affected party uncertainty around what is going to happen when. And Commissioner Marsden was talking to you around land purchase timeframes to make sure that certain elements of the project can be delivered. I think he used the example of the stormwater management. You know, you're not going to have three patches of land acquisition without the fourth bit that you need to deliver the whole of the system. So So my question is a little broader around than that, and it's around the need for the 15 years. And the approach I'm coming from is that I believe Mr. Skelton and possibly Ms. Bell touch on this, around the time frames involved to design, consent, and deliver the early aspects of the project. And I'd like to sort of refer to section 184 of the RMA, which I think you touched on page 54 and 55 of your legal submissions. And my understanding of section 184 is that there is an allowance of time for implementing a designation. And my question is around how much work do you need to do in broad terms to have satisfied the requirement, the designation to have been implemented?
Great question. So first of all, my reference in the submissions to section 184 was just simply the nod to 184.1c, which enables a designation to be specified for a different period and also to be challenged. But your broader point around given effect to, I think, in essence, and that sort of case law around when might a lapse period no longer be relevant, and what would the developer or consent holder have to have done to satisfy the give effect to. And again, it's one of those very helpful RMA areas, which is all deeply contextual, and can be, you know, necessarily has to be something more, usually even for a very small project, than a spade in the ground. But for some smaller projects, I think there was a Kawanui airfield house case where someone had sort of just started to let construction contracts, and their neighbor argued that they hadn't given effect to their house consent and it should be cancelled by the district council, but the environment court found that the homeowner had done enough to give effect to that. Something like that would quite clearly not be enough in the context of this. So I suppose all I can say at this point is speak in the general around what that well-understood case law and give effect to is. I think the broader question, though, and again, I might kick to Mr. Skelton in particular. I'm hearing a range of theme of questions around staging and timing. And I think the question, as I understand it, Commissioner, that you're asking is, do you need 15 years if there's a high likelihood that you will have given effect to around, say, some of the staging works proposed, and when that's going to happen? Is this even actually an issue we need to worry about? Is that sort of spot on? Right? Okay. Good. So I think around that sort of staging and timing question, that's certainly something that Mr. Skelton can address you on, but will certainly reflect what you're saying as well around give effect to.
Thank you, if you could. My understanding of the information for us at the moment is that you're talking 3.5 to 4 years for design and consenting, and sort of 4 years maybe for the enabling works of the perimeter road, the noise bunding, moving the NIMT. So that's sort of 8 to 10 years. So I'm just wondering where this sort of 15 requirement is coming from. So if you could reflect on that, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
I think that's enough for now.
Thank you, sir.
So it might be appropriate just to have a quick break and then we'll go to Mr. Moyle rather than just go straight into him. Is that convenient to you?
That would be very helpful. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.